Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today is Ben Gooderson, whose debut novel for middle grades, Winter House, was published earlier this year. Winter House was an Indie Next pick and a Goodreads featured new release. Publishers Weekly called it a satisfying mystery that leaves just enough unanswered questions to have readers eager for the next book in this planned trilogy. Ben, welcome to Inside the Writer Studio.
Thank you very much, Charlie. I'm very pleased to be here.
So even though I'm writing for adults and you're writing for children, I notice lots of connections in our novels. We both have old libraries, missing books, ciphers, and we'll have a chance to talk about all of those things as we discuss today. But I wanted to start with the picture that you paint of this eponymous and mysterious hotel where the novel is set, the Hotel of Winter House. Part of that picture comes from the illustrations of Chloe Bristol. What's it like to work with an illustrator, and did you guide her? Did she guide you? How did that relationship work in terms of the relation between text and pictures?
Well, I'd like to take some credit for, having located Chloe, but frankly, the book company, Holt McMillan, found her and reached out to her and got her involved with the book. And fortunately, she's going to be on for the rest of the trilogy, books 2 and 3 as well. I suppose I could have had sort of a veto power over the choice, but absolutely no need to, of course, because her work is incredible. It's very beautiful. And, you look online and see the range of other stuff she's done. It's just incredible. And I think most importantly for Winter House, she really captured some of the sort of gothic, dark or atmospheric aspects of the story. And I'll tell you something very interesting. I've had a number of people say that it reminds them a little bit of the artist Edward Gorey.
Sure. Yeah, I can see
and,
that.
Yeah, and Gorey, had a lengthy career, and he actually illustrated a book called The House with a Clock in Its Walls, which was made a huge impact on me as a kid. It came out when I was in about fifth grade or so. And Gorey was the illustrator for that book. And there's something very, very marvelous about this connection that just by happenstance, Chloe's work kind of echoes Gorey's. And Gorey was the illustrator for a book that really had a big influence on me when I was a kid.
Yeah, I can certainly see the gothicness of her illustrations, as you said. Winter House itself put me in mind of a lot of hotels that I know, both fictional hotels and actual hotels. It reminds me of some of the grand hotels in my part of the world, in the American South, like the Grove Park Inn and the Greenbrier. It reminded me of those national park hotels and out west, and even fictional hotels like Stephen King's Overlook Hotel. Did you draw from real or fictional hotels when you were creating Winter House?
Well, I drew a bit from a real hotel that I've never had the pleasure of visiting, actually. It's up in the Rockies of Canada by Lake Louise. And I can't recall the name of the hotel right now. I think it's gone through various owners over the years. But I've seen this dramatic picture of the hotel several times. It's this, enormous hulking thing of, it's got to be 10 or 12 stories, and it's very broad and wide, and it sits by beautiful Lake Louise, and the mountains are on the far side, and the lake is just crystal blue, and it just looks magical. And I must have come across that picture years ago, and it just always remained in my mind. I'd love to take an actual trip to that place, but the photograph itself was just so evocative and has always stayed with me. And I just kept thinking about, wouldn't it just be wonderful if you're a kid to earn some sort of magical vacation to a place like that and spend the holiday season.
I can't believe when I was listing fictional and real hotels, I didn't think of Lake Louise Hotel, because I have been there. And it is exactly what you say, the sort of isolation of it along that lake. There's no city nearby or anything. Definitely, I can see how that connection with Winter House was made. So tell us the basic premise of Winter House.
Well, Winter House is, again, it's a middle grade novel, maybe ages 8 to 12, roughly, I'd say. It is about a girl named Elizabeth Summers, who, as in a number of these stories, she's an orphan. She lives with a cruel aunt and uncle, and she has a life with which she's not too pleased. And she's a huge bookworm. That's sort of the solace of her existence, is she really loves to read. When she's 11 years old, she wins this mysterious and unforeseen trip to a place called the Winterhouse Hotel. She's not sure how this has happened. Her aunt and uncle are very poor, and she actually envisions it maybe as some sort of punishment. She just thinks it's going to be kind of some gloomy place that her aunt and uncle have shipped her off to somehow for the Christmas season. But when she arrives there, it's this lavish, huge, magical place. And, of course, immediately she falls totally in love with it, all the more so because at the Winterhouse Hotel is an enormous library. I mean, the library is three stories tall. It has thousands and thousands of books in it. And so for a person like Elizabeth Summers, it's just the ideal place. Plus, everyone there is just unfailingly kind to her, and she just immediately falls in love with the place. However, there's a legend floating around that there's a magical book hidden in the library, and Elizabeth starts to wonder if some of the people who have both befriended her and also have sort of frightened her at the hotel might have some deeper connections to the book and maybe some other mysteries going on in Winterhouse than she might have first imagined. And so she moves deeper and deeper into the mysteries of Winterhouse and learning about what's actually going on there, even as she makes friends with a boy about her age who's also visiting the hotel. So they have adventures and they solve puzzles and there's codes and there's some danger and a little bit of magic, especially as you get deeper into the story.
So you mentioned puzzles. I want to delve into that a little bit. Some of our listeners may know I'm a fan of and collector of the works of Lewis Carroll. And you begin each one of your chapters with a word game that he actually invented in the 1870s, which he called doublets. A lot of times people call it a word ladder now. We see it show up in the New York Times crossword puzzle all the time. So I'm curious if you were you intentionally referencing Carroll, and if so, why? But also, what role do those word chains that you start each chapter with play in your narrative?
Well, I was referencing Carroll in some small measure, because I'm a huge fan of classic middle grade literature, and I really love a lot of the older ones just immensely. They've just played a big part in my life as a young person, as a teacher, and as a father. So I wanted to pay some kind of tribute to those stories. And you or readers might notice I've included some titles or referred to some titles throughout the book, because Elizabeth Summers loves them as well. But I also love wordplay, and of course, so did Lewis Carroll. You read his books, and that's immediately apparent to you. And he has all these, you know, crazy, interesting poems throughout his books. And people are always questioning one another around the meanings of words and how words are being used. And I just really have a fascination with that. All sorts of puzzles and wordplay. And so the initial connection between Elizabeth Summers and her new friend, a boy named Freddie Knox, who she meets at the hotel, is that they're both sort of obsessed with wordplay and goofing around with puzzles and codes. And when she first sits down and meets him, they start working through a word ladder. He shows her something that he's taped to the bottom of his laptop computer, because he's really into inventing things. And she's immediately intrigued that there is a boy who would be as interested in wordplay as she is. So I thought that was just sort of a fun element, and I just thought it would be kind of fun at every chapter heading for there to be not only the title of the chapter itself, but that one word in the title would sort of drop down three, four, or five words and morph into another word that would have some significance within the given chapter itself. And hopefully, you know, kids and all readers might find that kind of enjoyable.
I think one thing I like about it is just the way it looks on the page. It imparts this very interesting design and kind of non-traditional design to the way the chapter head looks. And then again, I'm immediately drawn to those two words and think, okay, what's going to be important about these two words in the chapter, and kind of, you know, looking out for those things. Now, I have to admit, I'll put you slightly on the spot here, that I could not resist taking those word ladders and seeing if I could accomplish the transformation in fewer steps. and every once in a while I could. And do you see the possibility that your young readers might be doing the same thing? Or did you even intentionally maybe take an extra step so that the reader could have that sense of triumph of, oh, he did it in five steps and I could do it in four?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really fun to try to engage readers in a variety of ways. I mean, you know, as authors, we try to paint these pictures and evoke these imaginative experiences in our readers. And of course, we love when our readers can enter into that. I've always been the kind of reader, I also like to sort of look for other things. And if there's something going on that's very interesting with the way the author uses words and plays around with things, I just think that's really cool. So, you know, if kids are looking forward to the start of each chapter because they want to see if they can, you know, outdo me or do it in fewer steps, I just think that's all to the better. I love looking for little hidden extra things in books or magazines or whatever it might be. When I was a kid, there was the magazine, Mad Magazine, and sort of opened me up to sort of a satirical way of looking at the world. And I remember that in the corners of almost every page, this guy would do these little tiny drawings, these sort of one panel little scenes or something. And I just kept wanting to turn the pages to see what inventive new thing that guy could come up with. So I love those little extra flourishes whenever I'm reading something.
And as you mentioned, it's not just in the chapter heads that these puzzles are incorporated, but really throughout the text, Elizabeth and Freddie are playing puzzle games with each other. They're trying to solve puzzles, every kind of puzzle from a 35,000-piece jigsaw puzzle in the lobby to a mysterious puzzle that's going to reveal some of the mysteries that you alluded to earlier. So I think, again, you have these opportunities for them to become interactive. One of the things I love that they do is the two kids will sit down to begin a conversation and they will talk to each other in anagram. Somebody will say something and the other one will immediately reply with an anagram of the thing that they said. And again, I think it's an opportunity for there to be some sort of interactivity with your reader.
Yeah.
So you worked in high school and middle school as a teacher. You worked as a programmer for Microsoft. How does somebody like that end up writing a middle grade book? What was your journey and how did your journey and your experience influence the writing of Winterhouse?
Well, I, out of college, became a teacher, a real strong tradition of education and learning and the written word in my family, and really honor my parents and my brothers and sisters with that. We've all been educators at one time or another, so it was very natural for me to become a teacher, and I was very gratified in that role. I taught for 7 years high school on the Navajo Reservation down in New Mexico when my kids were very young and my wife and I were just getting started with our lives, and then taught for 3 years at a K through 12 school in Colorado. And I loved, I taught English, of course, and I loved working with kids or young people. It was just really a gratifying experience, and I loved sharing with them my love of literature and language and writing. I don't know how effective I was as a teacher, but I really enjoyed that experience. After a decade, I transitioned to working at Microsoft. I'm from Seattle originally, so it was a return to my hometown area for us. At that time, I had three kids by then. And I actually was not a programmer. I'm not a tech person. I worked as a program manager. It was mostly I started off in editing and then in human resources and really enjoyed my time at Microsoft, but in many ways sort of was looking for another path forward. In the background, I was always writing, and it felt natural to me, Charlie, just because of my love of reading and love of literature and love of language. And I just kept writing and writing and writing. I wrote a nature guide to the Southwest over 20 years ago. And after that, I tried to write a series of adult novels. And I never really got much traction on it. You know, I got some interest here and there. But it wasn't really until I tried a middle grade novel that I really felt the inspiration and the forward progress to be able to bring it to completion. And then was fortunate enough to connect with a great agent, Rena Rossner, and then Christy Ottaviano at Holt. Some really, really great people who helped me immensely to to bring this vision of Winterhouse forward. So I would say the main thing for me is, as I'm sure you may know yourself and have heard from other writers, I just loved and love to write. And I just kept doing it, you know, 6-7 days a week for 60 or 90 minutes every day. And even with the rejections or not making the kind of progress I liked, I just kept going. And I'm just very glad that I was able to bring a book forward that kids and maybe even adults will enjoy reading.
I was teaching at high school, my old high school, for several days, and I started each class with talking about, you know, sort of how to become a writer. And the most important step, I told them, is simply persistence. And it sounds like you definitely have experienced that in your own career. So you are clearly, I mean, I'm sure part of it comes from your having been a teacher, but you're clearly very steeped in, as you say, sort of the classics of children's literature, even before we use those words like middle grades. And there's certain tropes that kind of come up. So I was having a conversation with a YA novelist recently, and we started talking about this rich tradition of orphans and isolated protagonists in children's literature. And when we first meet Elizabeth, she, as you said, she's an orphan. She's been sent off to live alone with a cruel aunt and uncle. We're put in mind of, you know, Harry Potter and many other sorts of isolated protagonists at the beginning of children's books. What do you accomplish narratively by putting your protagonist in that kind of isolated situation?
Well, you know, it is a trope. It does have a long history, this thing, but I think it has a very strong basis in sort of children's psychology, if I can take it that far. I once read a great book by Bruno Bettelheim. It was called The Uses of Enchantment, and it's all about how the basically, if I recall correctly, it's about how, like, the Grimm's fairy tales have this lower strata that appeals to something in our unconscious that really matters in a way that is deep in a way that a lot of stories maybe may not be. And one of the elements of it is that there's some aspect of all of us where we sort of question our parentage. I don't mean this in any heavy or weird way, but, you know, you grow up and sometimes as a little kid, you think to yourself, are my parents really my parents? And, you know, that's certainly, you know, thoughts that could come to people. And we start to wonder who we truly are and what our destiny is. And, you know, are we sort of a greater lineage or something than we might be? And there really has to be something to that, because it's a kernel of so many classic and great stories, from mythology all the way through, as you say, Harry Potter. And so I think that that aspect appeals to kids, and it is in some ways very satisfying for them to enter into that kind of imaginative experience of thinking through, like, maybe there's a deeper destiny for me, and maybe I'm part of a larger family or something like that. And can have these magical experiences. You know, we mostly all come from great families and loving parents and so on, but I think it's kind of fun to put yourself sometimes imaginatively in the shoes of someone who has a different experience. And that's sort of my best guess on why that theme has persisted in children's literature.
Yeah, I think back to my own childhood and to my daughter's childhood. When I would play imaginative games, they often began with, I'm alone on a desert island. And hers often began with, I'm an orphan. And I think part of it, I look again back to Alice, is about the child wanting to be able to turn the tables and to be in a position of control. And if there's no adults in your life, then you're the one who runs the game, you know, whereas Alice begins very much out of control and surrounded by these insane adults that she doesn't know how to deal with. And by the end of the story, she's kind of seized control. So to me, I think it's almost an essential part of growing up to dream about that isolation as a child.
In Winterhouse as well, it gives Elizabeth a chance to sort of experience a life unencumbered by the fact that she's the poorest girl in town and she has these mean aunt and uncle and so on. So she does sort of get a chance to recreate herself. And it's a very liberating thing for her and allows her to mature in a way that she would not have otherwise.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. It gives her this sort of freedom and this open opportunity. We've talked a little bit about some other children's books, but you actually mention a lot of them by title, especially in the early pages of your book. I just jotted down a few of the ones you mentioned: Anne of Green Gables, Mary Poppins, Tom Sawyer, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Golden Compass. Do you hope to draw your readers to those other books, or do you think readers who have already read those other books will have, I don't want to say a richer, but a slightly different experience with your text than if they, than if your text is one they encounter before they encounter those classics?
Well, I think it's both. You know, my hope is that someone reading, if they see a title and they've read it themselves, a little light will go off, or a little smile will come to them, where they make the connection along with Elizabeth, because she's the one who references the books throughout. Whenever something happens, she'll sort of say, "Oh, that's like something I read in this book, or something I read in that book." So, you know, I hope that readers who've read those books will like that. But also, yeah, I hope that someone who hasn't read those books might say, "Well, wow, that sounds kind of cool. Maybe I'll take a look at that book when I'm done reading Winterhouse," and that would be fantastic.
So to go back to the physicality and the geography of Winterhouse again, you give us a lot of details about the geography and about the surroundings. We know, I try to pay attention to these little details. I noticed at the very beginning that the currency is dollars, but you don't specifically say what kind of dollars. So there's a vagueness left to what country are we in, what exactly is our location, that I have to think is intentional. Why did you decide to keep it vague like that and not say, you know, in the Rocky Mountains or up in Canada or some other specific spot?
You know, I don't know if I can fully account for that, but I think there was something going on in my mind where if there was too much specificity around the location, it might make it less, I don't know if universal is quite the right word, but I wanted to have some mystery or indeterminacy around where you were. Obviously, it's North America. It's somewhere up north where it's cold. So maybe it's Canada or, you know, somewhere in Montana or something like that. But it just felt like it might anchor it a little too much in a very specific, maybe even limiting location. If I said, you know, it's Hotel X near Kalispell or something like that, it just seemed like it might allow some of the magic to evaporate just a bit. I don't know if I'm correct on that, but I just wanted to keep it a little bit hazy where you were, while also rooting it, you know, in the north somewhere. You could very easily be in somewhere up in Idaho or up in you know, the Rockies in Canada, no doubt about it.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right to keep it, to not nail it down like that, because I think another thing that I see in children's literature, and especially in middle grades, is, you know, the reader wants to imagine themselves as the protagonist. And if their protagonist is in a specific place that the reader knows that he or she will never be, it's a little harder to make that leap. Whereas if it's just, oh, they're in some cool hotel, well, that could be close to me, you know.
Yeah. You know, I'm drawn to books and stories that are basically in our world and our universe. There's some little inflections or little changes or some elements of mystery and even magic or the supernatural, but it doesn't pull you too far out of the orbit of where we are right now. I like science fiction and some of that stuff a bit, but I'm not the hugest fan of straight out sci-fi. I really like stories that are set in our world, and they just start to drift out of our world a tiny bit. And so I really wanted to keep things rooted where they are and have the reader just have a little bit of a question about where exactly we're located. But they're not on another planet, and there's not, you know, there aren't talking animals and things like that. Even though those stories can be done beautifully, and of course I love the Narnia stories, but for me, I think I feel more comfortable in worlds that are, you know, about 95% our own.
Right. And that sort of leads me to my next question, because it's the question about time. Winterhouse reminds me, in its sense of being lost in time, again, of another fictional hotel that I think of, the Grand Budapest Hotel. Uh-huh. But it feels there's something that feels very old-fashioned about the hotel, you know, this wooden jigsaw puzzle and these, you know, bellhops wearing the sort of classic attire. And I think the illustrations contribute to that. And yet, as you said, the kids have laptops. There's technology that makes it clear that we are, you know, more or less in the present day. And I'm curious about how you saw the sort of timeless and the contemporary interacting in the novel.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Grand Budapest Hotel. I really loved that movie, and I had really drafted most of the book before I saw it. But yeah, that whole Wes Anderson style and the appearance of the hotel and the lavishness of the layout and all this stuff that goes on inside really fires my imagination. So it's great that you mentioned that. That movie and that quality of sort of that dual dimension of modern and classic is definitely at play in my book. I'm very respectful, I like to think, of the classics and of classic literature. And I just think that they are classics because they tap into and touch on so many things that tend to be universal and that persist. You know, the stories about friendship and love and maturity and, you know, rivals and all sorts of things that we look to as we try to understand our place as we grow up. And that's why, you know, some stories like Treasure Island or Anne of Green Gables are still read today. And so I wanted to bring that sensibility to Winter House. I personally love that old-fashioned feel or flavor, whether it's, you know, a Tiffany shaded lamp or a cherry wood desk or you know, old-fashioned candy or rolling ladders in the library, whatever it might be, there's something very charming and reassuring about those sorts of things. Even as I'm very much an occupant of the modern world, and I want my protagonist to occupy the modern world and not be intimidated by it. But I like for them to have an appreciation for older things as well as being able to move in the contemporary world.
Right. I think I'm going to be selfish for a little bit now and talk about some of the connections between your work and my work, because I also write novels that try to attempt to give the readers an opportunity to have the past be alive in the present, I guess is the way I would put it. So one of the reasons I was excited about your novel is not only because of the library, I mean, because of the hotel, but because the hotel features a library. And I write a lot of novels with libraries in them. It's my favorite space in Winter House. I think a lot of readers are going to feel the same way. I think your protagonist feels the same way. So for those bibliophiles who are listening, give us a little tour of the library. What's it like? What's special about it? And where did you draw your inspiration for creating that particular library?
I will. Beforehand, though, I want to say I did read The Lost Book of the Grail of yours, which was fantastic. And I see so much overlap in sort of our sensibility. And just one small element that really speaks to me on these about these dual dimensions we've been discussing. You even mentioned there about how nicely Penguin paperbacks age. And I thought that was a great mix of sort of, you know, paperbacks are maybe looked down upon by many book collectors, I guess. But a lot of us love paperbacks. And you sort of very nicely described how well Penguin paperbacks in particular can age. And I love that. And I'm a fan of Penguins myself. The library at Winter House, as I say, is three stories. It is presided over by a librarian named Leona Springer. She herself, and she's now in her 70s, she visited the Winter House Hotel when she was about Elizabeth's age, you know, when she was 10 or 11. And also fell in love with it and resolved to return and eventually became the head, or I should say the only librarian of the library. She's got a card catalog. She doesn't have things. It's not computerized or digitized in any way. There are plenty of spaces for reading. There's, you know, stacks or bookcases everywhere. There's busts of famous writers. There's stained glass of famous writers. There's a huge sort of overarching vault way at the top at the middle. And there's a reading room. There's a reference room. that ends up playing quite a role in the story as things go on, where you're not supposed to take books from that area. But she is she keeps a well-ordered, tidy library of which she's very proud. And there are actually in the book a lot of guests who come to stay at Winterhouse, which with all the other marvelous things in it, they come solely because of the beautiful library, and they intend to spend 2, 3, or 4 days or whatever there, and just spending time poking around the library, reading and finding books and enjoying themselves there.
I think we've all had the experience of being in a nice hotel and looking at the guide, and it says, oh, there's a library on floor 5 or whatever. And you go to the library, and it's an urn of coffee and some magazines from about 6 months ago and one shelf of spy novels that have been left in people's rooms over the years. So to have this kind of glorious library just tucked away in this hotel, I thought was absolutely wonderful. So one of the other ways that I see your work and mine connecting to each other, and this is something that I was teaching, as I said, teaching school earlier this week, and I talked to the students a lot about this because they were working on a project that related to this, and that is the idea of putting embedded text into your book. I do a lot of text within text in my novels. Sometimes they're excerpts from old books. Sometimes they're letters. They can be, you know, a variety of things. And you have a particular text within the text of this novel, which I don't want you to tell us too much about because I don't want you to give away the game. But it's a really intriguing, I think, text within the text. And I wondered if you could tell us a little about what it was like to create that book that Elizabeth finds. And did you write more of it than actually appears in the novel? Because you give us these sort of names of chapters and sections that are very intriguing. And I just can't help but wonder, did he write some of those out that we didn't get to read yet?
Well, there's a couple books actually in there where it's a text in a text. There's one part where there's a journal that Elizabeth comes across of a member of the family who runs the hotel, who since deceased left, and she reads that and finds some things. But there's also another book that I think you're referring to that has some sort of interesting chapter headings. And I didn't actually write any of those out, but I did give a lot of thought to them. And I was basing some of the more prosaic chapter headings there on some books that my son used to have when he was a kid. There are all these old books like The American Boy's Omnibus, and there are a few titles I can't recall, books from like 100 years ago with all these different sort of crafts and interesting things that, you know, there are these books that came out a few years ago, something like the Daring Book for Boys or the Daring Book for Girls, you know, right. And it's kind of a takeoff on those old style ones. And I love books like that. It's just chapter after chapter of, you know, how to make your own telescope or how to make your own bubble blower, all these little crazy things that kids find so much fun. So I thought, gosh, it'd be really cool if she found a book like that. And you know, and then what if that book had something a little more to it that she eventually delves into? So I love thinking about books within books, and I even, you know, adult literature that I love to read. I love finding that kind of stuff, whether it's a Borges story or something from Nabokov or whatever it might be. Whenever there's a book inside of a book, I my imagination just goes wild for that stuff.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned those sort of kids' books from 100 years ago about how to do this and how to do that, and there were magazines. You know, kids didn't have iPods to entertain them. They entertained themselves. And yeah. The novel I'm working on right now is set sort of in that time period in the early 20th century in the world of sort of children's series books, the series that eventually led to things like The Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. And it was really fun to try to create a chapter here and there of fictional versions of those books, because it's a very different kind of writing style than what we're used to in the present day.
Yeah.
So another place where our books connect, and in this case, I'm talking specifically about The Lost Book of the Grail, which you mentioned, is the use of a cipher. And I know I had a lot of fun creating the cipher that I use, but you actually used a real one. Can you tell us a little bit about the cipher that they discover and what it was like to kind of figure out how to encipher the text so that the kids ultimately would be able to decipher it?
Yeah, it's called the Vigenère cipher, and it's got quite a history behind it, and existed in different and maybe less complicated forms, you know, way back in history. It's not super complicated nowadays with all the technology that can be used to crack these things. And I'm definitely no cipher expert or anything, but I came across this Vigenère cipher and just thought it was really cool. And I thought it was at about the right level of complexity for the protagonist in my story and also for the readers. It's not so difficult that it would start to lose people. Essentially, there's an alphabetical grid, and you use a keyword, and you sort of lay the line of text that you hope to encrypt atop the grid by using the keyword. It's difficult to describe, of course, in words here, but it's you need to know the keyword in order to both encrypt and to decrypt the thing. And in the absence of the keyword, you're going to be pretty much lost. And at most previous points of history, you probably would have been completely lost if you didn't know the keyword. So I have that occur as something that Elizabeth and Freddie discover. They get really interested in this cipher, and they see these lines of what appear to be nonsense in a painting in this immense portrait gallery that's in Winter House. It's on the pages of a book that's sitting open on the lap of the founder of the Winter House Hotel, a man named Nestor Falls, who's the grandfather of the current proprietor of the hotel when Elizabeth is visiting. And so they want to figure out what these strange lines in this book on Nestor Falls' lap could possibly mean. And they connect it to some things they've read and found out about the Vigenère cipher, and they figure that's got to hold the secret. Of course, what they need to know is what's the keyword. So throughout the story, Elizabeth and Freddie are on a hunt to try to figure out what could possibly be the keyword so they can unlock the mystery of these lines of apparent nonsense. Of course, built into this is some deeper magic around Winter House itself. But I really enjoyed learning about the Vigenère cipher. I didn't realize it was actually used to create codes during the Civil War to transport messages that way. And a form of it was even used by Julius Caesar. I think it had a slightly different name, of course, back then. But the concept of needing a keyword has been a constant in history. And the Vigenère cipher is a lot of fun. I'll tell you something really, really cute. I had the good fortune to do a reading at a great independent bookstore, kind of like Bookmarks. I found you're involved with Bookmarks there in Winston-Salem, which sounds like a wonderful place. We have one near me in Redmond, Washington, called Brick and Mortar. And I had the good fortune to do a reading there. And a young reader who couldn't make that reading, she left a note for me. And a part of the note was a coded message, and she left me the keyword all in the Vigenère cipher. And it just really, you know, tickled me to read that. It was really a sweet little note she left. So that was kind of fun.
I mean, I think that's a perfect example of the kind of interactivity we were talking about. And readers will discover that you actually produce the Vigenère square in the book and explain to your readers how to do the cipher so that they could test their own keywords as they're reading the book. If they want to guess what the keyword is, they can actually try it out. And I'm sure you will have readers who do that. So we've talked about ciphers and about mystery and about this grand hotel. But to me, really at the heart of it, this is a story about friendship. And at one point, Elizabeth forms this thought, and I'm quoting from your book right now. She thinks, maybe part of being a friend to Freddie meant respecting his interests just as much as pushing her own. What do you think Winter House teaches about friendship?
Well, this girl has led a pretty isolated, lonely life and has found that books are her truest friends. And in some ways, she's retreated into books quite a bit because she feels awkward, but also they're the safest place for her. Nothing wrong with that for those of us who are book lovers. But it has maybe stifled her a bit in terms of how to be a friend to other people. And so under these liberating circumstances of being sort of a new person at Winter House, it's opened her eyes a bit to the dynamics of friendship and what it means to think a little bit less about her own her own needs or her own wants or her own desires and what it means to put someone else first. And she realizes that in her desire to uncover these mysteries she's encountering in Winterhouse and a semi-obsessive nature that she starts to cultivate a bit, she's maybe overlooking her new friend's needs. And so she has to figure out how to balance that. And I think we all go through that regardless of the age we are, but definitely when we're younger. What does it mean to move from being a person who the whole world revolves around you to being part of a complicated social circle and trying to make friends in a way that's genuine give and take and not just all designed to gratify your own needs. So, the book isn't super heavy in that regard, but I hope that some readers will maybe see that as an element of Elizabeth's developing personality.
Yeah, and I really like that relationship because it's not, you know, it's real. They have their ups and downs. They have things on which they really agree and they come together, and they have times when they're in conflict, and that's yeah. the way a real friendship works. So yeah. One of the things I really admired about the book was the way you draw the minor characters with sort of this deft hand where it doesn't take very much to kind of understand who they are and what they're like, and also to give them this mysteriousness. So you mentioned the librarian earlier on who was one of the ones I really like. And she says this, she's talking about the library, but she says, when people come here, they take something away with them, just like when you go to a beautiful museum or a wonderful park for the afternoon. What would you like your readers to take away from the experience of reading Winterhouse?
I want them to not just escape into a story. I like to read stories to escape, but I find the books that linger with me the most and that are richer are ones where there's another layer there that you take away. And as we mentioned just a moment ago, I would love for them to take away some sense of the magical possibilities that exist everywhere, whether it's through codes or through making a new friend or through reading a great book. I'd love for people to take away some sense of enchantment from the book. And most of all, I'd love for young readers to take away a sense of, gosh, I really enjoyed reading this book, and I want to read more books. They don't necessarily have to be authored by me as by any stretch. I just would love if someone who's maybe a reluctant reader comes away from this book thinking, wow, I want to check out some of those other books that were mentioned in Winterhouse, or I heard about this one from my school librarian or my friend, and I'd love to look into that. So that would be an enormous win or nice takeaway as far as I'm concerned.
I think Winterhouse, certainly I would describe it as being an advocate for both reading and for the classic books of English and American children's literature in particular. So we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. They're all short answers. There will be no grades, so you're perfectly safe. But hopefully they'll give us a little something to think about and give us a little extra insight into you, into your writing. So are you ready for the speed round?
I'm ready.
Okay. What word do you love to work into your writing?
That's a tough one because I think more around how a particular word fits into a given sentence or paragraph. So I don't know that I have a particular word in mind, but I love the sound of words. Ameliorate, enigmatic, fabricate. I'd love to work those words in somehow.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
A word like narrative. I think it stretches too far sometimes. Or a word like innumerable, which seems kind of vague or maybe inaccurate. Those kinds of words make me pause when I'm reading.
Where is your favorite place to write?
I have a nice little office up here that actually is the ex-bedroom of my daughter who now lives in Michigan.
Where could you never write?
Perhaps a coffee shop. I'm not that distractible, but there's too much motion or noise. It's difficult for me to focus.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
I like to occasionally split an infinitive. Ah.
What's the first book you remember reading?
Plenty of picture books when I was a kid, but the first book the first sort of novel that I thought, wow, this is really doing something to me, was The Phantom Tollbooth.
What are you reading now?
I just started The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. I reread The Iliad recently, and I'd heard about this book, so I wanted to check it out. And a collection of writing by Bertrand Russell, who's a thinker I really admire. And I can't help saying I just finished rereading The Wind in the Willows, which is just a phenomenal book. And every time I read it, I come away more amazed than before.
What book would you like to have written?
Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov. Mm.
What sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
I'd like to write a fabricated biography, but I don't know that I will, and I probably definitely will never write a volume of poetry.
What would you like to hear a reader tell you?
Sort of what we were mentioning just a few minutes ago, I'd love a reader to say, your book has made me want to continue to read more books of whatever sort.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. My guest today has been Ben Guterson, whose new middle grade novel, Winter House, is available wherever books are sold. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Charlie, thank you. Huge pleasure. I really appreciate you inviting me on.
Coming soon on Inside the Writer's Studio, I'll be talking with Elaine Neal Orr about her new novel, Swimming Between Worlds, set right here in Winston-Salem. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.